You're listening to TheStreet.com's Real Story. Visit anytime for this and our other multimedia products.
European debt worries and bad housing numbers sent stocks lower today, but still we ended up off the worst levels. Welcome to The Real Story, the show we go beyond the headlines, tell you what's really happening on Wall Street. Let's get right to the numbers. Dow was down 46 to 11,006. Still, it's above that 11,000 mark. S&P down 7 to 1,181. NAS down 27 to 2,498. Gold up $16.90 to 1,382.90. Oil down $1.68 to $84.05 a barrel, and the 10-year now yielding 2.79. We had better than expected consumer confidence numbers. We had better than expected Chicago PMI. However, the Case-Shiller shows that housing still has not corrected itself. In terms of currencies, it now takes $1.29 to buy a euro, so the dollar is strengthening against the euro. Weaker against the yen today, it now takes 83.69 yen to buy $1. The VIX, I checked on that. That was up 8% today to 23.25. So things are getting a little bit shakier on the market. That's the fear gauge. In terms of most actives, you had Citigroup, of course. That finished up slightly to $4.20. Bank of America finished at $10.95, down 3.2%. People are saying that that may be the next WikiLeaks, that there are some problems over at BAC. We're going to watch that. Ford down 1% to $15.92. And Baldor Electric is getting purchased by ABB. That stock was up 40% today. Over on the NAS, the most actives included Microsoft, which finished down slightly at $25.25. They're doing very well with their Kinect. And Cisco finished at $19.13, had an absolutely awful November. Come to think of it, this is the last day of the month. We're heading to December tomorrow. In terms of sectors, the financials, the XLF, which is the select sector spider, down 0.7% to 14.43. People are worried about that WikiLeaks. All right, great show today. I speak to Doug Noland. He's the portfolio manager for the Federated Prudent Bear Fund. We talk about why he thinks we're going to have a bearish 2011. Speak to Nainesh Shah. He's from the five-star Roosevelt Multicap Fund. We talk about some of his picks for next year. I speak to David Orrell. He's the author of this book, Econo-Myths. He talks about why economists are always wrong, and they usually are. And then finally, I speak to Mike Gregoire. He's the CEO of Taleo. That stock has done very well over the past year. All right, whole lot of economic data out today. Some of it good, some of it bad. In terms of consumer confidence, came in at a better-than-expected 54 in November. Its highest level since June and well ahead of October's 49.9, so we're heading in the right direction. Consumer expectations also jumped to 74.2, the highest level since May and up from last month's 67.5. So it's nice to see that the consumer has been bolstered a little bit, feeling a little bit more willing to spend some money, feel good about themselves. On the other side of the dial, the Case-Shiller Home Price Index showed a 0.7% fall in single-family home prices in September on a non-seasonally adjusted basis. The S&P called the move a sign of a clear deceleration in home price returns. So if you think that we got to have home prices moving up and in order to get a sustained rally, this did not help your case. But if you think that it's all about confidence, well, the consumer confidence numbers were helpful. The other good economic number that came in today was the November Chicago PMI came in at 62.5, much better than expectations. Analysts were looking for 59.6. It's also ahead of the 60.6 we got in October. So this is a good number ahead of the November ISM tomorrow. All right, now I talked in the intro that people are worried about Bank of America, that there might be a big WikiLeaks about it. Everyone's watching this gentleman, Julian Assange, to see what's going to come out of those government cables and the government chatter that he downloaded. Some people say he stole it. People wonder what's going to happen next. So in an interview with Computer World last year, here's what Assange said. At the moment, for example, we are sitting on 5 gigabytes from Bank of America, one of the executives' hard drives. Now, how do we present that? It's a difficult problem. We could just dump it all into one giant zip file, but we know for a fact it has limited impact. To have impact, it needs to be easy for people to dive in and search it and get something out of it. And so yesterday in a Forbes interview, Assange said that the documents could take down one or two banks. So this pressured the banks today, certainly Bank of America. We're going to watch that. Speaking of pressure, our friends over in Europe are still under pressure, which was a terrible David Bowie Queen mixture, just to let you know. And it didn't help with that whole, what was it? Was it Vanilla Ice who did the remix? Anyone in the production studio can help me out on that one? Either way, that was a terrible Queen David Bowie song. But we're going to move on. This is from Citigroup, their chief economist, William Buiter, B-U-I-T-E-R, I think that's how you pronounce it. He had nothing nice to say about Europe. He says Greece is de facto insolvent. He says Ireland is de facto insolvent. He says Portugal is less dramatically but quietly insolvent. I yanked this from Gus Lubin, who took it off of FT Alphaville, just to let you know. Spain, here's what he says about Spain. For now, the markets have put Spain in Italy's sovereign risk class, when in our view it should be closer to Portugal and Ireland once its banking sector problems are recognized. So I guess what he's saying is it's de facto insolvent. And with regards to Italy and Belgium, here's Citi's chief economist, quote, at longer horizons, high debt levels and political instability in Italy and Belgium may yet give rise to fundamentally warranted sovereign debt crises, while self-justifying crises are possible even in the near term, despite roughly balanced structural primary budgets. Right, so it looks like they have balanced budgets, but at some point they may be, once again, dot, 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 there's your ellipse, de facto insolvent. I guess we're going to watch that. And on the other side of the coin, you need Germany to pick them all up. And Germany actually had some good news today. German unemployment improved again to 7.5%. This is from the AP. The Nuremberg agency said 2.931 million people were unemployed in November, down 14,000 from October. The first time the number of jobless had been under 3 million in 2 years. So good for Germany, because they're going to need all those working people in order to support all those pigs, all of peripheral Europe, probably England at some point, certainly France. And it's, you know, it's just amazing what's going on out there, because Germany owns a lot of this Irish debt. Everything is so intertwined over there. And hopefully what we're seeing over there won't be what we're going to see over here. I spoke about the Barish case with Doug Nolan. He's the portfolio manager. I was going to say the prime minister, but no, he's just a portfolio manager for the Federated Prudent Bear Fund. Not a lot of bear funds out there. And look, you know, he's a bear, but that's a way to invest. If you think the market's going to go down, you invest bearishly. Not making him un-American. It's just an option for you. Fund's got $1.8 billion in it. And over the last 10 years, it's returned 5.2% on average annually. So, you know, it's something you got to maybe put a little bit of your money in into a bearish fund. Diversify. That's the only free lunch on Wall Street, or so they tell me. Anyway, I wanted to find out whether or not Doug Nolan, who's the prime minister of the Prudent Bear Fund, is looking for a bearish 2011.
Yes, our thesis for the past 18 months has been that we're in a bubble environment again. That the, you know, the 2008 bursting of the Wall Street mortgage finance bubble, and the response to it, monetary and fiscal response, global as well as here in the U.S., kind of unleashed what we've referred to for a while as the global government finance bubble. So we think we're very much in a bubble environment. As long as the bubble is accommodated by loose finance, then that bubble can expand. The markets can become even more speculative. But the underpinnings are fragile enough that we fear that when financial conditions inevitably tighten, we'll be right back in a crisis environment.
Well, it's not hard to see the bear case nowadays, because it's all over the world. We got WikiLeaks here. We got Ireland melting down over there. We have municipalities going broke over here. What do you think is going to be the catalyst that really sets us off to head lower?
Well, I see a lot of parallels between the Greek crisis this past spring and the subprime. The eruption of subprime back in the spring of 07. And to us, we believe the Greek crisis is a catalyst that will lead to a bursting of this global government finance bubble. You know, the subprime crisis took a while before it made it to the heart of the credit system, and now we see the Greek crisis expanding to Ireland, Portugal, even U.S. municipal finance, we believe. So, you know, we've seen a lot of government intervention, but not a lot of success in rectifying these structural debt issues. We think the serious crisis unfolds when the markets finally discipline Washington and discipline our Treasury and the Federal Reserve.
You said that the markets have to discipline Washington. We heard President Obama freeze federal wages for a year or 2 years yesterday. Can he do the disciplining himself? Can he discipline the government before the markets have to?
I don't think so. And we've seen globally that governments, you know, they hesitate to do anything too dramatic until the markets force it upon them.
It's just not popular.
Right. And for years now, we've been convinced that Washington can resolve our problems, and we still believe they can, but we just fear that they just compound the issues.
You're sounding like a bond vigilante, though. And when you run your portfolio, you're shorting a lot of stocks, right? Which sectors are you most worried about?
Well, it's been an interesting environment for us as bears in that we've had to really focus on risk and risk control, and we've been in that stance since late 2008. So for us, we don't have a lot of big sector calls right now. Our biggest short exposure is just being short the S&P. To us, as we're trying to be a reliable hedging instrument, but also focus on risk. And right now, just being short the S&P probably is a better risk reward than a lot of the stocks and sectors. We certainly think that the huge run in consumer discretionary, retailers, restaurants, et cetera, that's going to provide us an opportunity down the road because we still think the U.S. economy has a long way to go to restructure. But we don't like to short, you know, the high flyers or momentum. So we backed away from a lot of the sectors that fundamentally we're the most interested in.
Sounds like you think the consumer is going to crack. And this is what you're saying so close to Christmas time?
What a Grinch. But
bah <you're>, humbug, Mr. Nolan.
Well, our thesis is right now is that if you even look at the Federal Reserve's own data, over the past 24 months, federal borrowing is up $3.6 trillion. So there's never been anything quite like this, but that's what stabilized incomes, corporate cash flows, the U.S. economy. So everything looks okay right now while we're running these massive deficits. But again, it'll all come back to the point
when the money dries up.
When the markets discipline Washington, then there's the next stage of the crisis.
What differs the Prudent Bear Fund from a lot of these short ETFs out there? Because if we want to short the S&P, we can do it through lots of different vehicles. We can do it one time. We can do it two times. We can do it three times with some ETFs. So what do you guys do differently?
Yeah, we have a unique approach. I guess at the end of next month, I'll have wrapped up 21 years of managing money on the short side. We don't believe that a short product should be 100% short all the time. Almost all of our competitor products are fully short always. We don't want to do that. We want to be more short in an environment like 08 and then ratchet back the risk, protect shareholders in an 09 environment. So we focus on risk reward, and we definitely vary our short exposure and the composition of that exposure based on our analysis of the market environment.
You're smart bears, like Yogi.
We,
you're not like Boo Boo. You're like Yogi.
We want to be like Yogi.
Yeah, all right. Now let's talk about gold. Now, a lot of people put gold in their, and they consider gold part of their short portfolios. Do you own any gold or miners?
Yes, and we always have. We've always had a long component in Prudent Bear. It's our resources portfolio, mainly precious metal mining companies. We like that as far as picking stocks in that space. It also works as kind of a nice macro hedge for us because as bears, we always think our biggest risk is government-induced reflation. And during those periods, 03 comes to mind, 09 comes to mind, that portfolio helps mitigate some of our short exposure.
A lot of people say there's a bubble in gold. Now, what say you on that score?
Well, we don't think there's a bubble in gold. It may benefit from this bubble that we have in global government finance, right? As we devalue credit across the globe, then hard assets like gold certainly are a much better store of value.
All right. Now, finally, this is something I've been talking about on The Real Story quite a bit lately. Munis. You got to worry about the municipalities right now because you have that Hamtramck over in Michigan, which is going to go bankrupt. You have Harrisburg in Pennsylvania, which is, I don't know, I think they're going to go bankrupt at some point. I know they got a little bit of money from the state of Pennsylvania. How worried are you about munis? And states, you know, California, Illinois, and New York, perhaps defaulting on their municipal debt and on their municipal bonds. And can you play this in your fund, or is this just all a part of the grand call that we're all in a whole lot of trouble?
Well, we think the municipal market is one that deserves a lot of attention. If you look at the general market, let's go back a month or so ago, the perceptions globally were that, you know, we were in this environment of QE2, maybe QE3, 4, and 5, endless liquidity as far as the eye can see. In that environment, no one really cares about credit quality. Actually, the weakest credits tend to perform the best in that type of environment. Now, all of a sudden, the environment's changed where the markets are perceiving that maybe QE2 is the end of the line. Asia has an inflation problem. So all of a sudden, the market perceptions of future liquidity has changed. And when that changes, then the market will kind of back away from the riskiest credits, Ireland, Portugal, and U.S. municipal finance. And the problem always is when finance leaves a particular sector, especially when it's vulnerable, that's when the problems start to surface. So we think there will be a lot of problems surfacing in muni finance over the coming years.
You bummed me out this morning, but I appreciate hearing the truth from Doug Nolan. He's the portfolio manager from the Federated Prudent Bear Fund. Thanks for coming on The Real Story.
Thanks for having me.
Before I forget, The Real Story is nominated for some award for Best Business Podcast over at podcastawards.com. So if you really want to throw me a warm fuzzy and not a cold prickly, go to podcastawards.com and vote for The Real Story for Best Business Broadcast Podcast. Whatever it is, it's cheap. It doesn't cost you anything to listen to this show, and you get some great CEOs. So certainly go on to podcastawards.com and vote for The Real Story. Now let's talk about some stocks before the next interview. Got a new CEO over at Merck. Kenneth Frazier is the new guy over there, down 0.8% today, the 34.42. And he's taken the reins from Richard Clark. He had to go because of mandatory retirement age guidelines. That's not fair, but he's going to stay on as chairman of the board. Barnes & Noble was down 5.7% today to 14.02. Company this morning missed fiscal second quarter estimates and forecast this quarter and the year below estimates. Seems like they're just caught in that battle between the Riggios and the Burkles. And while they're fighting, nobody's buying Nooks. Or maybe they are. RIM, let's see. Research in Motion got an upgrade. Look at that. It's been a long time since I was able to say that. RIM was up 4.7% to 61.80. Jefferies & Company analyst Peter Misek raised his rating on the stock to buy from hold. Slapped an $80 price target on it. His prior target was $55. He says he's been checking channels. He hasn't been changing the channels. He's been checking them. And he says that the Playbook tablet computer is going to provide a great browsing experience, and he expects big things from that. Which reminds me, my wife's birthday, December 8th, she wants an iPad. Someone remind me out there. I'll send you a book. And once again, the books are going to the folks in Iraq, the troops over there. But thanks for the emails anyway. Moving on. Trina Solar down 6.4% to 22.36. Company this morning easily beat third quarter revenue and profit estimates, raised its outlook for the year's photovoltaic module production, which they make in their flux capacitor, of course. And then Akamai was up 0.6% to 52.19. Lazard Capital's Colin Sebastian, there's a guy with two first names, says Akamai should benefit from a strong start to the holiday shopping season. And on the he says that the whole Netflix thing where Akamai lost some business to Level 3, he says that's not going to make a material impact on Akamai's revenue. And it also shows that Akamai is not a monopoly, which is a good thing. All right, I spoke to Nainesh Shah. He's the portfolio manager for the five-star Roosevelt Multicap Fund. So I had a bear on, and I wanted to get a bull on, someone who's bullish about 2011, who has some five-star fund picks for you. So I wanted to find out what Nainesh Shah had to say about 2011.
When you think about what's going on around us, we are bullish. When you think about what Ben Bernanke had said back in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and when you think about the QE2, we think, and then on top of that, Ben Bernanke had that op-ed article in Washington Post, we think that Fed is very supportive.
If Ben Bernanke is putting all this money into the system, the best place for it to be is in stocks, and that's where you want to be.
Absolutely. And we think that not only U.S. stock market, but rest of the world and also commodity can be very interesting play.
That doesn't sound a little bit artificial to you, that basically just because some guy is giving you money, then you got to put it in stocks? I mean, doesn't this... something's a little bit off about that for me.
Yeah, it
wouldn't it be great if the economy was rolling and that's the reason to buy stocks as opposed to something like QE2?
Well, you know, what we have gone through in 2008, that was a serious economic problem.
It was a heart attack.
Yes. And so the question is are we going to come out on our own, or are we going to get some support? Without support, I think it's impossible for us to come out. And with support, we can come out. So what we are seeing, if you think about the numbers, we are seeing some mild growth, but some mild growth in the U.S. economy. And with QE2, I think we can see sustained growth.
Okay. So before we get to the stocks, what happens if those training wheels come off? So basically, if Ben Bernanke says, all right, I've given you guys a whole lot of money to play with. Here's all the monopoly money. And what happens when he starts taking it back? Is that when it's time to get out of the market, but for now we're in?
We think that QE2 can turn into QE3 and can turn into QE23 if it doesn't work. So I think it's all, from Bernanke's perspective, it's all in, and he's not going to pull out till it works.
I like it. Let's talk about some stocks. One company that you like is Tata Motors. Tell me why you like the Indian car maker.
Everybody talks about emerging market, and we had a theme in the portfolio which was more focused on India, which we have evolved, which this theme has evolved into emerging market consumer theme. But Tata Motors is right in that play. If you think about the middle class consumer in India and even China, Indian middle class is growing significantly faster. They have a lot of money on their hand, and where are they spending? They're spending on these consumer items. And Tata Motors, by making these small cars, Nano, that's $3,000 a car, is getting it's selling in the market. There is another part to Tata's story, which is they bought JLR, which is Jaguar Range Rover from Ford back in 2008. The company has turned around. They paid $2 billion. They're making $1 billion run rate right now from that company. It's a very interesting story, very well-managed company.
You know what the Indian consumer can also do now that they have some money? They can gamble it away. And one stock you like is Las Vegas Sands. Tell me why you like the casino player.
Las Vegas Sands is a play on Macau, play on Singapore, and also on revival of Las Vegas. But I think it's primarily growth in Asia. We have a theme in the portfolio called Asian Exposure, where we are looking at companies that is exposed to Asia. These are U.S. companies, but exposed to Asia. And Las Vegas Sands is doing very well in Macau and Singapore. And there is a currency play here, which is they are getting stronger currency, which when brought it to U.S., I think they make a lot more money.
Well, there's a currency play when I go to the casinos as well. When I go to the casinos, they take my currency, and that's how I play. Let's talk about another stock, United Airlines. Now, it's always risky to get into airlines, but they've seen some liftoff this year.
Very interesting time frame for airline. There is a lot of consolidation going on, not a lot of new supply coming on, and I think what they have is a pretty interesting pricing power. So when in the airline, it's a time to invest when there is a pricing power, and United, by buying Continental, and saving some cost, also has this a significant pricing power in front of them, and we think that there's a significant potential on earnings side and multiple side.
Finally, there's a stock you're involved with. I'm not familiar with it. It's Albemarle, and it's big in bromium. Tell me about this one, and you got to tell me what you do with bromium. You don't brush your teeth with it, right?
Bromium is used in multiple places, but I think one of the most interesting that we think about is protecting the environment. Utility needs bromium or will need bromium to reduce the mercury output from the power plants. And that's coming up in next 6-12 months time frame. And Albemarle probably has a one-third world supply under their control. And that, again, when you think about pricing power, Albemarle has a pricing power as well in bromium.
Nina Shah is a portfolio manager for the Roosevelt Multicap Fund. It's a 5-star fund. Thanks for coming on The Real Story.
Thank you very much for your time, Greg.
Swiss industrial giant ABB was down 1% today to 1936. I mentioned at the top of the show that they are buying Baldor Electric, which was one of the most active today. That stock was up 40%, Baldor Electric was. So, they want to get into the electric motor business, expand their presence there, because people are worried about tougher environmental regulations. So they're buying Baldor. Now, people are wondering what the hot gift or the hot item is for this holiday season. And it might be, it very well might be, Microsoft's Kinect controller for the Xbox 360. I yanked this over from Barron's. Microsoft said that strong demand over Black Friday weekend pushed sales of the Kinect to more than 2.5 million units sold worldwide since it's put on sale about a month ago. And what the Kinect does, I'm reading, because as you guys know, I'm fairly useless when it comes to anything digital or electronic, and I haven't played a video game since I had the Atari in my parents' basement back in 1980, I guess. I don't know. The Kinect allows individuals to affect action in a video game by capturing the individual's movements in a space through a sensor and transmitting that motion to the Xbox. So I guess if you bounce up and down in front of a Kinect, it'll show you bouncing up and down on the screen behind you when you're playing a game. All right. It's like, I guess it's like a little bit more than the Wii. Let's move on to something I understand, and that's Walmart. Walmart was up 0.5% today, 0.5% to $54.09. They said that traffic on the Black Friday rose 30% from last year. Good for them. And then on a sad note or a bad note, Apollo Group, the education company, was down 0.9% to $34. They're going to be laying off about 700 full-time positions, primarily among admissions personnel. Of course, if you've been watching CNBC, you've been seeing Herb Greenberg jump up and down about the problems in the for-profit education sector and having a total conniption over it. So that's what's going on over there. All right, who else did I have on today? I had on the CEO of Taleo. How cool is that? That stock has really outperformed the indexes over the last year, certainly a year to date. Stock was down 0.3% today to 30.70. Mike Gregoire is his name. They do talent-managed software. Stock is up about 30% year-to-date versus single digits for the Dow. And I wanted to find out what's driving that stock.
I think it's the realization that having the right employees can help both your top line and your bottom line. And being able to get into a mode of operation where you're constantly focusing on your people requires you to have tools to help you focus on your people. And that's what we supply.
All right. Talk about your tools, your talent management products. What exactly do you do for your customers?
Well, we have four flagship products. We have a recruiting module, which helps you get people into the company. We have a performance management module, which helps measure those employees, make sure that they have succession plans, development plans. Then we have a compensation module, which makes sure that they are compensated and that your compensation is in line with industry norms. And then lastly, we have a learning management module so that when you have these great people in your company, you can get them into some e-learning courses so they can improve with time.
Now, these are fantastic HR tools, but what a lot of people want to see right now is revenue growth. We've seen all the cost cutting there is. How can your tools help HR and help a company to promote growth?
Well, first of all, every company is constricted with respect to capital. Where you put that capital, you want to make sure it's in the highest probability for growth. When you invest in the right people, that has the highest probability for growth. So, for example, you know, buying a new machine, that's a fixed asset, a fixed cost. Buying someone who understands how that machine works or can market what's produced by that machine, that's where the real growth driver is going to be. And if you don't have the systems in place to be able to attract that particular individual or nurture that particular individual, all you have is a machine.
Where are you seeing the greatest demand for your products right now?
We see demand pretty much across the board, but there are some key industry segments that are definitely growing their employee population. A lot of healthcare. We're seeing a lot of growth in government, believe it or not, at the federal level. We see a lot of growth in some areas of manufacturing. And then, of course, all the service-oriented industries.
Is the talent migrating? Are people moving from job to job? Is this something that you can track with your software or you're hearing from your customers?
Unfortunately, people are moving from job to job. It's hard for anyone to understand this, but even in this relatively neutral to tough economy, there's still 40% attrition, 20% of it voluntarily and 20% of it involuntarily, which means that there's a wide degree of fluctuation with respect to workforces. And this is highly ineffective.
And your software can help mitigate or help deal with that flux.
We can help deal with the flux. We can tell you why that flux is.
So you're making a real flux capacitor.
I wish.
Like Doc Brown.
There we go. Back to the future.
But that's fantastic. So, you know, you're seeing people from company to company, even in a tight employment outlook. This is surprising to me. Are you getting a read on what's going on out there in the labor force?
It's called frustration. You know, people have not.
I'm familiar with that.
People have not had raises over a number of years. And what they're looking at is, am I the best fit for this particular job? Is this company investing in me? Do I understand the company's strategy? And will the company grow? And if you can't answer yes to all of those questions, they're more than happy to take their chances and try somewhere else.
Let's talk about the growth of your company. How are you competing with the big boys? You're growing very well, but you're still competing with the likes of SAP and Oracle. And although they are locked in a grudge match to the death, you know, you still got to deal with those two big boys.
Right. They don't do exactly what we do in that we are very focused on talent management. They are, you know, an old-time brick-and-mortar software company selling perpetual licenses where you might get new innovation out of them once, you know, every 3 years. And if you even get that innovation, the cost of putting that innovation in is highly expensive.
Well, Larry Ellison will just buy that innovation.
Well, he can buy that innovation, but you still have to pay to get that innovation into your company.
Okay.
And so what we do is we own all of that. We own the responsibility for upgrading. We put out two new very large releases a year that is filled with all of our 5,100 companies or customers to date's innovation, and we're able to make that happen a couple times a year. So you're constantly improving your HR processes.
All right. Now, I talked about revenue growth. Are people still using your products to cut costs?
You know, more they do look at it from a cost cutting, because if you're going to sell anything right now, you have to be able to articulate payback.
So it's ROI. It's the old ROI story.
You know, nobody's going to spend money without an ROI story. The issue here, or the benefit here, is it's not just an ROI story. It gets to what you initially asked, is where's the growth? Our software can help you pinpoint how your company is going to be able to grow by making sure you have the right people doing the right things at the right time.
Well, you must be doing the right thing at the right time, because the stock's doing awfully well. Thank you. Mike Gregoire, he's the CEO of Taleo. Thanks for coming on The Real Story. Email me at Greg, G-R-E-G-G, greg@thestreet.com, or you can go to iTunes, leave me a message there. Or if you want to be really kind, once again, go to podcastawards.com and vote for The Real Story as the best business podcast. All right, why is The Real Story so great? Because you get fund managers, both bear and bull. You get a CEO, Mike Gregoire from Taleo. And then finally, we got four for you today. Sometimes I do three guests, but today I've been busy. I'm going to give you an extra present, right? I had David Orrell. He's the author of a brand new book called Economyths, 10 Ways Economics Gets It Wrong. And I wanted to find out from David, first of all, what the biggest myth is out there.
One of the biggest ones has to be the idea that the economy is stable, that it reaches this kind of perfect equilibrium. So economists, they don't actually say that the economy is always at equilibrium, but what they do is they assume that there's an underlying equilibrium and there are deviations away from that. But the actual truth is the economy is better modeled as a system that is far from equilibrium, in the sense that you know, things are like constantly moving around, you have ups and downs. There actually is no equilibrium.
Should we just ignore every single economist out there? Because you have a great point in the book that in the beginning of 2008, they had a survey of economists, and overwhelmingly they came back and said, the market's going to go up, everything's going to be okay. And as we now know, in retrospect, everything fell apart.
Yeah, I think we shouldn't ignore all economists, but what we should do is take all economic forecasts with a grain of salt. Because, you know, we're all fascinated by predictions. We're all fascinated by the future. You know, we always want to know what's coming up so that we can position ourselves better for it. But we're not so good at looking back and seeing, you know, how good were these forecasts in the past. And if we do that, we find that, you know, predictions of, let's say, what will GDP do next year? What will currencies do next year? These are actually no better than random. So I think what we need to do is change our focus. So instead of trying to, you know, predict these things, what we should do is focus on ways to make the systems perhaps more stable in the first place.
You describe a number of economies in your book. You have the good economy, the unhappy economy, the unfair economy, the gendered economy, the emotional economy. What kind of economy are we in right now?
I think we're in an unstable economy, you know, because the big disruption, the credit crunch thing, has been going on. It still hasn't settled down. I'm based in the UK at the moment, and you know, with the situation in Ireland and contagion flowing out from that and perhaps affecting other countries, it's never been more clear that we live in an economy which is unstable, highly networked, and liable to these sort of contagious type effects, which are really not a well accounted for in traditional economics theory. And that's why we need to bring new ideas to the table. I mean, if you want to understand how a network system like the European economy works, if you want to understand how an event in Ireland can affect other countries, you need to take into account all sorts of things like network flows, the influence on investor psychology, all of these things. And it's just not well done at the moment.
So can you make a prediction? Are you in the prediction business at all?
Well, actually, before I wrote Economist, I wrote a book about prediction and about how bad we are at prediction. So it'd be a little bit, you know, inconsistent of me to like stand up and make predictions. But I think there are some predictions you can make. I mean, you can say one thing you can do is say whether a system is stable or not, whether, you know, and I think obviously the economy now is unstable. But what exactly is going to be its next kind of contortion is not something we can do.
Now, you are currently based in the U.K. However, you did your studies in Canada. Are you a Canadian?
I am.
A lot of people are saying very positive things about Canada's economy right now. Yeah. Are they stable?
They are in a better position, I guess, certainly. The banking network has really sailed through this crisis without too much damage at all, in part because they're a bit more conservative about risk, and they didn't go as far with subprime mortgages and credit derivatives and stuff like this. So, yeah, they are in a better shape. I'm sure they're feeling
very
smug at the moment.
Or are they stable or less unstable than us?
Less unstable because, I mean, you know, even though they have been doing incredibly well, they haven't really had a housing bust in Canada. With the result is that housing prices are now getting up to really unsustainable levels. You know, so it's we live in a bubble economy where, you know, Canada is affected by the low interest rates, which have followed the subprime crisis around the rest of the world. So that's kind of inflating their real estate market. At the same time, their economy is quite reliant on commodities. And, you know, the bubble's going on in commodities there, too. So no one can insulate themselves from this kind of thing.
Why couldn't the economists predict the financial meltdown?
A large part of it was the kind of risk models that they were using, because the risk models used by economists is basically they look back to see whether assets, how much they fluctuated in the past. So if something has fluctuated a lot in the past, it's considered to be relatively stable, like cash. But if it's been very volatile, then it's considered risky, like a biotech stock. Unfortunately, the U.S. housing market was an example of a stock or an asset which to them seemed to be extremely stable because it hadn't seen a nationwide decline since the Great Depression and just been kind of climbing rather steadily up. And therefore, you know, according to the mathematical models, it was possible, you know, the perceived risk was essentially zero. And so it was possible to build up a huge credit around this. Obviously, though, at some point, you know, if you didn't have the mathematical model, you realize that nothing can go on forever. Once housing prices get too high, they are vulnerable to a crash.
Now, every day you pick up the op-eds, either the New York Times, FT, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, lots of different economists weighing in. You have your Krugmans and your Stieglitzes. You have your Art Laffers. You have Ben Bernanke the other day had an op-ed in the Washington Post saying he's on the case and we're cool. You won't see inflation. He'll take the money out when the time is right. Hmm. What do you think when you read these op-eds?
My own feeling is that I think they suffer from a bit of an illusion of control, you know, which is that they think that if they do A, then B will follow, you know. In something in the economy, you know, things don't really work so well like that. At the same time, you know, I don't particularly want to try to second guess them because I feel that when you're in a crisis, people have to make decisions, and there isn't some sort of magical economic theory which, you know, you can pull out which will answer that question for them. They have to do what, you know, no answer is perfect.
So it sounds like there's two things. One, there's the law of unintended consequences, which will make everyone wrong in the long run. And two, what you're saying is they're doing the best they can.
Yeah. But where I think they're kind of lacking, actually, is in not doing enough to reform the ideas, to reform the institutions and the regulations which got us into the situation in the first place. And that's where the focus really has to go in the following years.
So they can work in hindsight and close up the holes that have been left behind or, you know, close the barn door now that the horses have gotten out, but we still should close them anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is where these economic myths come in because the thing is the reason that we kind of got ourselves into the situation is because we believe that the economy behaved in a certain way. We assumed it was a stable, self-regulating system.
Do you have a view, just as the final question, because we're already into overtime, a lot of people say that it was Ayn Rand and the free market and deregulation, which got Alan Greenspan and all his successors into trouble.
Yeah, it's always a writer's fault. Yeah.
Is no? Do you buy into that at all?
Well, a little bit, because I think the ideas about regulation are confused, you know, because we see a sort of a political thing quite often. I think there's a scientific case to be made. If you look at biological systems, the jungles are not regulated, but any kind of body, contained body, is highly regulated. Regulation is very important to make things work. So if we want the financial system to work as a whole, as a body, then it has to be regulated properly.
David Orrell. The book is Econo-Myths, 10 Ways Economics Gets It Wrong. Thanks for coming on The Real Story.
Thanks very much.
There you have it, another Real Story in the books. Thanks a lot for listening. I will be back tomorrow with more Real Story. Thanks for listening.
At Continental Airlines, we're proud to fly the newest jet fleet among global airlines based in the U.S. State-of-the-art, fuel-efficient planes that beg the question, don't you love that new plane smell? For reservations, go to Continental.com. Continental Airlines. Work hard, fly right.
AT&T works in more places. Whether you're texting directions to a friend, checking email on the go, or calling home from abroad, AT&T is delivering wireless for the way you live, on the go. AT&T is America's wireless leader, with more customers than any other carrier. So live wireless and stay connected to your family, your friends, your world, with wireless from the new AT&T. Your world, delivered.